Now, I made 5 videos now on the Flint Dibble Graham Hancock debate, and each one of them has been pretty well received, and I've had a lot of people ask me if I was going to put all the videos together when I'm done covering it into one big long video. I guess they want to like download it and listen to it as a podcast. I don't even know. I'm old. You're lucky I can edit these things to begin with, right? But anyway, my point here is it's going to be a month or two before I return to the debate. I've got Baalbek going, and I'm researching the crap out of that. I don't like to half-ass my research, sorry. So it's going to be a second before I return to the debate. So in the meantime, I'm going to put these 5 videos together so you can watch them as a podcast or whatever it is that you youngins do with these things nowadays. Are you old people that are doing things that I don't understand? I don't know. Again, whatever. You like long videos? Here you go. I've edited out as much of the junk as the intro over and over isn't there, and the outro, and blah, 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 blah. So it should pretty much flow together. Hopefully this works for you. Thank you very much for your support so far, and I hope you enjoy the Baalbek video. And for those of you that enjoy this sort of thing, I hope you enjoy this. Thank you very much. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to the Dunking. In the recent debate between Graham Hancock and Flint Dibble on the Joe Rogan Experience, Flint spends a lot of time discussing the domestication of plants and how we can tell if a plant's been domesticated or not. And this section is being touted as like one of the biggest wins for team archaeology in the entire debate. And indeed, it does seem like Flint very much knew a lot more about it than both Graham and Joe, and the case that he made does seem pretty watertight. But is it watertight? Are all the claims that he made accurate? Is there any glaring errors that might undermine his position? Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. As Flint makes his case for the record not showing the domestication of plants during the Ice Age, Joe asks him the following question.
But is it possible that this cycle of domesticating wheat and beans and all these different things has taken place many, many times? And that if you left them alone, they would go back to the wild form? How long would it take for them to revert back to their original
thousands
state?
Thousands of years again.
Thousands of years again.
Thousands of years.
How many thousands of years, you think?
Well, I don't know because I'd have to look that up.
Well, I do know, or at least I have a pretty good idea, because about a year ago, I made a video on feralization, and it's one of my earlier videos, and it's back in the days when I didn't script them, so it's kind of clunky, and by clunky, I mean the first half of it is me reiterating over and over again that I'm not a geneticist, so watch it at your own risk. But anyway, the point is, as soon as I heard Flint say that it took thousands of years, I knew immediately that that wasn't accurate. In the 2021 paper titled, When a Crop Grows Back to the Wild, Feralization, the abstract says, feralization can be considered, under many aspects, the opposite of domestication. During crop and animal domestication, the wild forms gradually become adapted, under a regime of artificial selection, to a new environment where humans intervene to control their growth and reproduction, e.g. in the agroecosystem. During feralization, this process is reversed. Domesticated races escape human cultivation, return to a wild environment, or in any case, start to propagate and reproduce without human intervention, and revert to phenotypes more typical of the wild forms. For example, typical phenotypes of feral forms are the invasive habitus of some of the plants or aggressive behavior of the Australian dingoes. Thus, feral species escape from a regime of artificial selection and adapt to a new environment in the absence of any deliberate human input, reassuming some of the characteristics of their ancestral, truly wild progenitors. Assuming you watch the debate, you'll know that Flint pointed out a couple of markers to look for when you're looking for domestication of plants, and basically they all revolve around seed shattering, and what that is the ability of a plant to like drop its seeds as soon as they ripen, which is something that humans do not want on our plants. So it's something that has been presumed to have been bred out for a long time, although I have to say that Flint does say this in the debate.
It's really cool because it's not human selection either. In fact, 40 years ago when we first started studying domestication, we thought that all this was due to conscious human selection. And now we know that it's actually the plant adapting to us and what we do.
So it sounds like the consensus is now different. What's not different is the reality of a plant that drops its seeds as soon as they ripen makes for a suboptimal food source, especially in regards to grains. Grains are already small, and the early grains were even smaller, so picking them off of the plants would have been hard enough. Gathering them from the ground would be absolutely tedious. And that's why we thresh grain. We beat the plant until the seeds fall off of it. This requires a happy medium, though. If the seeds won't fall off when you thresh the plant, it's almost just as bad as picking the seeds out of the dirt. The seeds need to shatter from the plant under just the right amount of stress in order to be an ideal food source. Now, as Flint mentions in the debate, there are two genes that control this process in wheat, and both are fairly well understood. In rice, it's a bit more complicated, with 3 to 5 quantitative trait loci controlling seed shattering and multiple paths to shattering present in the genetic record. Now, let me repeat that. There are multiple paths to seed shattering present in the genetic record. Different parts of the plant can be utilized to encourage or discourage shattering. The abscission layer is a part that forms near the seed to hold it in place until it ripens. It can grow earlier or later, thicker or thinner. The grains themselves can break off in a few different ways, and this is all present in the record. As a matter of fact, the genetic record of rice does show a solid potential for it to have been domesticated and then feralized into domesticated again. I mean, the QTLs, the quantitative trait loci that dictate this in rice, they're numerous, and it's a weedy mess, pun intended. But to give you an example of just how crazy this whole thing is, in the paper, Asian wild rice is a hybrid swarm with extensive gene flow and feralization from domesticated rice, we read the following. The domestication of rice remains controversial, with multiple studies reaching different conclusions regarding its origins. These studies have generally assumed that the populations of living wild rice, or Rufipogon, are descendants of the ancestral population that gave rice to domesticated rice, but relatively little attention has been paid to the origins and history of wild rice itself. Here we investigate the genetic ancestry of wild rice by analyzing a diverse panel of rice genomes consisting of 203 domesticated and 435 wild rice ascensions. We show that most modern wild rice is heavily admixed with domesticated rice through both pollen and seed-mediated gene flow. In fact, much presumed wild rice may simply represent different stages of feralized domesticated rice. In line with this hypothesis, many presumed wild rice varieties show remnants of the effects of selective sweeps in previously identified domestication genes, as well as evidence of recent selection in flowering genes possibly associated with the feralization process. And this is from recent times. I mean, this is, just the last few thousand years. Try to suss what happened 15, 20,000 years ago, and it's going to be a whole lot harder to discern. Just listen to the titles to these two different papers. Molecular Evidence for a Single Evolutionary Origin of Domesticated Rice, or The Rice Paradox, Multiple Origins but Single Domestication in Asian Rice. Both of these papers can be found linked below, as can all the sources cited here, but the point is the waters are so unbelievably muddy, we cannot safely say rice was not domesticated during the Ice Age and feralized afterwards, only to be re-domesticated again. Matter of fact, that hypothesis would explain some of the anomalies we see in the genetic record. However, like most forms of digging into the deep past, unless they actually entertain the possibility of further back origins, the evidence could well be missed, even if it's sitting in a museum somewhere already. Now, some may be inclined to say that Flint was being dishonest when he said that about feralization, but there's a couple of reasons that I will say that's not the case. And the first one is that the feralization process completely does take a couple thousand years, they say. But the markers show up right away, like he was saying about domestication and stuff. And this is really, it's all about the plants reacting quickly to the environment, like Flint says.
Selectionary pressure. It's the pressure of humans now collecting it and then planting it. So as soon as there's one seed that's like that with that mutation, it slowly proliferates every single time humans replant it in a new field.
So those are subtly different from each other. And the second reason that I would say that he's not lying about this is that he's not a geneticist, and feralization is poorly understood even by geneticists. The thing is that, like they talk about at the end of the debate, like scientists need research funding, and when you're looking into the genetics of plants, the money tends to come in farming and stuff like that. So feralization, it only shows up when it actually is like beneficial to farming or something like that. Not only, but quite commonly, that's where you're going to see it the most. For example, one of the papers I used in my research is titled Diverse Genetic Mechanisms Underlie Worldwide Convergent Rice Feralization, and it starts with the following statement. Worldwide feralization of crop species into agricultural weeds threatens global food security. Weedy rice is a feral form of rice that infests paddies worldwide and aggressively outcompetes cultivated varieties. Despite increasing attention in recent years, a comprehensive understanding of the origins of weedy crop relatives and how a universal feralization process acts at the genomic and molecular level to allow the rapid adaptation to weediness are still yet to be explored. So the research has to have real-world benefits in order to get that funding, so it's not surprising that Flint's not aware, because he's not a geneticist, and that's the study of feralization doesn't really come up so much in archaeology as it does in, farming and stuff. So I give him a pass on that one. I don't think it's being dishonest. But when it comes to feralization, in the paper I mentioned earlier, When a Crop Goes Back to the Wild, the authors say, although these recent studies of feralization in plants revealed several genomic regions differentiating feral from their progenitor domesticated forms, it is not yet clear, and to what extent, feralization involved additional direct or indirect changes affecting plant metabolism and its regulation. That's a lot of word salad there, but basically what that's saying is they're not really sure what happens when things get feralized, but they're starting to figure it out. And that paper isn't even 4 years old, so again, not surprising he doesn't understand this stuff very well. However, the way that he portrayed it was to shut down the argument that Hancock was making, and in this case, you really can't do that. We don't know enough about rice in particular to say that it hasn't been domesticated and feralized and domesticated again. It quite possibly could have been. Then you'll, for those of you who've watched some of my other videos, you know that my prime candidate for Atlantis or Lost Civilization or whatever is Polynesians or Proto-Polynesians. So maybe they went to the sea when the Ice Age went to hell and the Younger Dryas and all of that, and so they left their rice behind and it just went back to the wild. It's speculation, right? But my point here is that you can't close the door on that with the genetic record or with the microscopic record even, because they don't know. They flat out say they don't know. They can't even find out from 1,000 years ago exactly which one of these has been feralized and which one's not. So when you look back 12, 20,000 years, no effing clue as we currently sit. Perhaps you don't believe me, but how about the Molecular Biology and Evolutionary Journal? The origin of domesticated Asian rice has been a contentious topic, with conflicting evidence for either single or multiple domestication of this key crop species. Now, of course, it makes sense that the plants would revert to the most optimal way to survive. I mean, if you think about a plant that's not throwing off its seeds, it's not seed shattering, its seeds are just sitting there in the wild, so instead of sitting on the ground and growing into the next generation, it's just a snack waiting there for the next thing that comes by that eats those kinds of grains. So it's kind of critical that it throws those seeds as soon as possible. So the very first generation, the ones that really don't shatter very well, they all get eaten, and the next generation shows that shattering coming right back. So it's just as fast as the domestication, it's the feralization starts right away. And I think that Graham and Flint both, if they thought about this for a few minutes, and Joe Rogan, all three of them, if they would have thought about this for a few minutes, I'm pretty sure that they would have come to the same conclusion. It's not that complicated of a concept, really, when you think about it. But, and, you know, it's in the heat of the debate. You get all emotional. Everybody knows how that goes. You get all angry and pissy and fight. And, well, we end up with what we got. Now, I'll be responding to the rest of this debate like I did this part, really, in piecemeal, where it's like one point at a time. That way we can get into the details, and it's not like some big all-encompassing thing. That's what the debate was for. I'm going to talk about the individual portions of the debate, and we'll look into them and look behind the curtain, right? And for those of you who haven't watched me before, be well aware that I swing both ways and that I will criticize Hancock just as quickly as I criticize Dibble, so don't get all pissy with me when you show up in the next video and I say something you don't like, because all my subscribers have seen me say something I don't like, so just roll with it, baby. Around here, I call them like I see them, teams be damned. And you know, I wanted to respond to this part first instead of doing it piecemeal just in order, and the reason was twofold. Number one, this is like one of the biggest points being bandied about right now is proof of this big win, and it's not quite the big win that they seem to think it is, in my opinion. Doesn't seem like that adds up quite at all. And the second thing is it kind of proves that you need to look behind the curtain here. You need to actually check your sources, especially in this community. My God, you absolutely have to check everything that anybody says about anything, even me. In the Flint Dibble Graham Hancock debate, Flint made the case for metallurgy being something that we know for a fact didn't happen until relatively recent times. I'll let Flint explain.
And I'd say we could definitively prove there was no large-scale metallurgy in the Ice Age. If you look at ice cores in the Arctic, right, we can track metallurgy of the Roman period, of medieval periods, based on lead emissions that end up in these ice cores. And there are no emissions from metallurgy in the Ice Age.
Well, that seems pretty cut and dry, but as we saw in the last video, it might not necessarily be so. So let's take a look under the hood and see exactly what we've got here. Out the gate, what Flint said is fundamentally accurate, as far as how they determined if metallurgy occurred in a time and place. They look for heavy metal in the ice cores mostly, but also in bogs, caves, or other places where potential contamination of the samples gathered is small. Humans have created an impact in the amount of heavy metals present in the environment ever since we first harnessed fire. Burning wood releases some of these trace elements, and these have been used to determine if people used fire in a site or if they did not, especially in caves where they build up. Mining and smelting also releases heavy metals, more of them, so the traces of lead, copper, cadmium, cerium, and other metals are used as indicators for this activity. Lead is the more universal and abundant of these, and it shows up in all the metallurgy chemical signatures, which has caused it to be used as the standard indicator, a baseline for metalworking of that time and place. Notice I said time and place, and that's the first thing to mention here is the way that Flint words that in the debate makes it sound very definitive, like, we take some ice cores from Greenland, we know the whole entire globe's metallurgical history, game, set, match. And that's not really how it works. The ice cores in Greenland won't tell you anything about the metallurgical activity in the Andes up until like more modern times when it becomes a hugely industrial scale. But you go back 1,000 years, there is nothing in Greenland from the Andes. To find the history of metallurgy in the Andes, they took ice cores from the Illimani Glacier, which is in the Andes itself. They didn't even go to Antarctica or use the tons of ice housed at the National Snow and Ice Data Center to check Antarctic cores. They had ones from right next door, but convenience wasn't the only reason that they stuck to these cores. They were able to obtain a local signature of copper and lead in the natural dust of the environment by looking back further than they expected to find signs of humans working metal. In the paper itself, titled Ice Core Evidence in the Earliest Extensive Copper Metallurgy in the Andes 2,700 years ago, they explain it like this. To discriminate between the natural and anthropogenic origins of copper, enrichment factors were calculated. Enrichment factors are ratios of trace element concentrations to a lithogenic element such as aluminum, cerium, iron, ionathium, neodymium, and titanium, which are normalized to the same elemental ratios of a reference material such as the global upper continental crust or the regional background. So in order to determine the difference between the background levels and those caused by humans, they had to have a good reading of the entire region from before humans started messing with the stuff. And that makes sense, but it's very much regional is my point. It's not like you can just like grab a few ice cores and know what's going on around the entire world. That Illimani Glacier that they pulled the ice from in the Andes, it's just as useless when you try to work out what's going on with ancient Rome as Greenland is for working out what happened in the Andes. It doesn't give you anything. So all these things have to be done on a very regional level, which makes it very obvious if they have not tested the ice cores near where Hancock's lost civilization was said to have been, they wouldn't be finding the things that they're looking for. So that's the first thing to mention here is that Flint's watertight argument has a kind of a big hole right there when it comes to place. But what about time? I mentioned time as well. What else about that? What else about that? Man, I'm good with the words. Well, anyone who looks into the scientific stuff regarding lost civilizations won't be surprised by the issue we see here. They simply don't test far enough back in time with enough detail to tell us about metallurgy in the time Hancock's lost civilization is said to have existed. For example, the paper on the Andes I mentioned earlier goes back 6,500 years, about halfway. A paper titled Environmental Impact of Roman Mining and Its Correlation with the Archaeological Evidence, A European Perspective, that sets out to do just what the title says it is. Well, it goes back about 4,000 years. Basically, when looking for human influence via heavy metals, they look a while farther back to find that regional background, that baseline, and after that, they just use the time frames they're focused on to get tested. And this makes sense. These ice cores are expensive to obtain, hard to test, and the funding for any project is limited. So it's no fault of the scientists involved when they don't test ice cores going back 30,000 years when they're looking for signs of humans working metal. That would make the research many times more expensive, and since they assume there's nothing to find there in the way of metallurgy back then, it sounds like a waste of funding to them. And I don't disparage that one bit, I totally get it. But when Flint uses this to debunk Hancock's lost civilization, he's not really looking at all the angles here. I mean, yeah, we got ice cores going back hundreds of thousands of years, but they test for general lead in the environment. They're not using those specific fingerprints and backgrounds and stuff like we've been talking about, so they can't say with any certainty. They don't tell the same story, okay? They just talk about lead in the environment. They don't talk about all the fingerprints of metallurgy. To make certain my assumption about this was correct, that the scientists involved don't test for lead very often in older ice cores, I asked Dr. Peter Neff, aka Icy Pete, and he helped me out as you can see. Now I have to say, he's one of the scientists with respect for the lab coat. You don't really see him acting the ass on the internet and compromising his image as an impartial researcher. So if I was you, I would go give him a follow. After I wrote this script, but before I recorded, Flint found the freaking thread where I talked to Dr. Peter Neff. Even though me and Flint both have each other blocked now on Twitter, he found the thread and he posts this scorched earth crap where he wants to make sure that no scientist will give me any information whatsoever. I guess, you know, science educators nowadays are afraid of people that might use science in a way that undermines their bullshit on Joe Rogan. I don't really understand exactly what his reasoning is there to make sure that nobody talks to me, except for it does very much demonstrate he is a science educator second and a personality on the internet first. Much science, big influence. Now, in my last video, I didn't explain it well enough, I guess, but I did show that rice has a strong possibility of having been domesticated, returned to the wild, and domesticated again. I was still accused of simply playing Atlantis of the Gaps, which normally is a fair criticism, but in that case, and in this case here, it is not. We do have evidence in the record of repeated rises and drops of lead in the ice cores from Antarctica, and these rises and falls, they directly correspond to changes in the climate. During periods, like now, when the glaciers are lower than normal, we see more lead in the record. In times when the glaciers are at their height, we see less lead in the record. This is as regular as clockwork, and of course the scientists have taken notice and they have an explanation. More dust kicked up when less water covers the earth makes for more metal in the ice cores, that's what they say. But it could very well be humans working metal, certainly not on the scale that we do now, but it would track. It gets warmer, we start messing around with things, including metallurgy that shows up as lead in the record. It gets colder, we throw rocks and sticks at each other for a few thousand years, not so much lead in the record. Gets warmer again. My point is that when Flint says, no, you cannot have it for certain, there's no way there was metallurgy, it's like, man, I could easily look at this graph and be like, well, I mean, how do we not know that there was metallurgy or not? What we would need to do is to find all those little other trace elements, the fingerprints, the regional things that we talked about earlier. And that's pretty complicated, right? That normally would seem like the kind of thing would be like, well, sorry guys, don't know what to tell you here. But actually, I've got an answer for this one, surprisingly enough. Remember earlier when I mentioned all that ice and the archive at the National Snow and Ice Data Center? The answer is probably there. Well, more specifically, at the National Science Foundation Ice Course Facility, where over 17,000 meters of ice are stored from around the world. 17,000 meters is roughly 55,775 vinyl records for you other Americans. But my point is in that facility, the ice is available to be examined, kind of, in a frozen room and with all kinds of other special precautions. In other words, it's not available to me or to you, but to guys like ICP, it most certainly is. So, now, obviously, like I said earlier, you know, a normal scientific bit of research, they're not going to have the funding to just go doing all this kind of stuff. But if we financed somebody that, you know, was able to do it, kind of like, you know, like David Koch or the Edgar Cayce Foundation did when it came to carbon dating the Great Pyramids, we could actually check and see if there are signs of metallurgy in the record. The ice core data is it's housed. All we have to do is go dig into it and look at it. But again, I can't do it and you can't do it. So my point is this is a way that doesn't require a trip to Antarctica for us to see if Dibble or Hancock is right. Are those jumps in the lead in the record between glacial periods from human activity or not? See, this could give us some actual answers. Do we have chemical signatures of smelting, mining, or the like in these prehistoric times? Or is it just dust? Or does human history follow the pattern many believe it does? A serpent eating its own tail, a never-ending cycle of cataclysm and rebirth? As I said in my last video, the answers could be on a shelf somewhere and we wouldn't know it. Well, in this video, I can tell you where that shelf would be. Well, science is a beautiful thing. I wouldn't have to worry about getting too wordy in these videos if I didn't love science as much as I do. Easy for me to talk with too much jargon because I read 20 papers and look up a bunch of definitions and forget that my viewers have not done all that. I love the science because it answers questions like nothing humans have ever utilized in the past. But the way it gets used to debunk ideas can very often be overzealous, and this is a perfect example. We simply have no data from the appropriate time period to conclusively tell us whether or not metallurgy occurred. But we do have times when it looked like it may have, long ago, during the lowest glacial periods. But this isn't going to look good on Joe Rogan as far as Flint's concerned, and it most certainly would give Hancock too much wiggle room. So if your intention is to debunk him instead of fairly evaluate his claims, you really don't want to mention this. Now, since I've already covered two parts of the debate now, and I haven't said anything really too critical of Hancock, I wanted to point out for the people that are like, this guy never even said anything about Hancock, here's a video where I talk about the Bimini Road. Here's a video where I talk about Ganong Padang. Both of those you will find that I am not at all in agreement with Graham Hancock's position. He is not my golden grandpa. I can't really call him a golden child, can I? Even though I'm ancient, he's ancienter. Things just keep getting older. There was one thing that Flint Dibbles said on his debate with Graham Hancock on the Joe Rogan Experience that pretty much everybody can tell was just off. And that was the part about the 3 million shipwrecks.
We can think about shipwrecks, right? Graham has mentioned that the bulk of marine archaeology has focused on shipwrecks and not the continental shelves. And so the thing is, at this point, we have something like 3 million shipwrecks from around the world.
Obviously, the vast majority of these are going to be from recent times. I mean, there was this little thing known as World War II that happened that I think one or two boats might have been sunk during. But Flint uses this whole thing to jump off into claims about boats that are directly related to Hancock's lost civilization.
And so one of my questions for Graham is, if this is a global civilization with ships, why is it that we don't have shipwrecks from this global civilization? I see this as a big, big problem. If we're looking for a civilization that's traversing the oceans, we should find these shipwrecks.
And he proceeds to make quite the case, one that we're going to go over in detail, and we'll see if he inflates the abilities of science or the knowledge that science has, like he did the numbers of shipwrecks there. Joe did a great job moderating the event, and one example of this is the way that he would press issues and ask questions repeatedly until at least he felt that the issue was resolved. And he did that with Flint on the shipwrecks, and the result was Flint saying this.
There's this idea that things just decay the older they are, and that's really not true. It depends on the burial environment that they're in. So taphonomy is what archaeologists use to study how things survive and how they are there. Mm-hmm. And so typically when things are buried, they're very stable. Or when they're, you know, sitting, it depends on where you are on the bottom of the ocean. But typically it's very, very stable.
Taphonomy is indeed the science of how things survive in the record, and there have been many studies that are done on marine taphonomy itself. We will focus on wood for the purposes of this video, as boats made of wood are the most common in the historical record, and would be the most likely candidate to have been used as a construction material for the ships of Graham Hancock's lost civilization. Wood is hands down the most common boat-building material of all time, and was still the most common until up about 150 years ago, even in our advanced Western cultures. And Flint tells us that...
Would it stay that way for 20,000 years, you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's this idea that things just decay the older they are, and that's really not true. It depends on the burial environment that they're in.
And the environment part is right. The rate of decomposition absolutely does depend on the environment. But he also says the idea things decay faster the older they are isn't true, and you got to compare that with what we find in a paper titled Wood Taphonomy in a Tropical Marine Carbonate Environment, Experimental Results from Lee Stocking Island, Bahamas, in which it says, duration of exposure, depositional setting, and the amount and continuity of burial all contribute to the amount of Limnorrhea attack on the surface of the wood. Limnorrhea is one of several wood-boring parasites on the ocean floor. You can see what they found after just 2 years underwater. This piece of wood is 2 centimeters across, and it looks like Swiss cheese. These are microbes, by the way. This isn't the only wood-boring thing in the region. The paper discusses the slow disintegration of wood. Several types of wood, mind you. Over the course of just 2 years, they track significant loss of both volume and mass due to these things eating them. Obviously, this stands in stark contrast to the comment that Flint made.
There's this idea that things just decay the older they are, and that's really not true.
Which, to be fair, may be from Flint's experience as a terrestrial archaeologist, and this is marine taphonomy, and he does conflate them.
So taphonomy is what archaeologists use to study how things survive and how they are there. Mm-hmm. And so typically when things are buried, they're very stable. Or when they're, you know, sitting, it depends on where you are on the bottom of the ocean.
So perhaps that's where his confusion is coming from. But like he said, the environment is crucial, and basically it's the determining factor as to whether or not wood or other organic material survives long periods of time in the ocean. Which means what you're probably thinking is correct. When Joe spoke about the endurance and its amazing state of preservation, it was due to the environment. Specifically, the endurance sank in icy cold Antarctic waters. To quote the British historian Dan Snow, it's probably below zero. There's no wood-eating microbes and microorganisms damaging the vessel. Now, I think everybody watching realizes that the longer it's on the ocean floor, the longer it's going to be eaten by those microbes. So when Flint says that the ocean floor is relatively stable, that really stands in stark contrast to the expert opinion. The consensus among scientists working directly in the field seems to be best summed up by award-winning science journalist Kit Chapman writing for the Royal Society for Chemistry. The state of a shipwreck depends on a host of factors. How long it's been underwater, the materials it's made from, the depth, temperature and currents of water, whether it's sank or fresh in salt water. These factors also affect the kind of creatures that will try to make the wreck their home and that are responsible for most of the damage and degradation. The Endurance was so well preserved because the microorganisms that typically devour a wooden wreck do not live in the cold, hostile waters of the Antarctic. So the statement that is typically stable is flat out wrong. If you're a piece of wood, the ocean floor is a hellhole of things eating Swiss cheese and stuff like that to you. And if it's cold, you're in better shape. And there's other factors that can apply as well. If you're buried with silt, you could be in better shape. Or if the salinity is really high or something like that. There's a number of different things that can play into this. But one of the ones that does play in almost everywhere is chemical equilibrium, or like homeostasis.
So in general, wood will decay. So, in a lot of underwater environments, it'll just preserve as long as it's in homeostasis.
This is basically the chemical balance between the object and its surroundings. Once it chemically doesn't stand out, it's not really food or whatever for the other critters. And at this point, barnacles and the like will usually cover the object, which then will cover the ship in concretions, they're called. They're hard, mineral-rich layers that serve as a sort of armor. This will protect the shipwreck from further predation. Even the current has trouble penetrating the rigid skin that the barnacles leave behind. This leaves these weird casts of the vessel. The ship's mostly gone with just little that remains is covered in hard minerals. You've seen these sort of images before. And once this has occurred, the ship can last for a long time in this state, but not forever. Eventually, the wood, because it's hollowed out, will collapse under the weight of the concretions, and the ship will be lost. This is why most shipwrecks, even ones that are considered generally well-preserved, are more or less piles of debris. Hey, Flint talks about one where the nets are intact, and this shipwreck is considered to be very intact.
I mean, the preservation underwater is amazing. There's this shipwreck off the coast of Italy that I just presented on the Bad Boy of Science YouTube about shipwrecks and stuff. And there's still the vine netting that was holding the Roman cargo was still preserved.
Wow. I mean, it is well preserved, but it's also a complete wreck. At 2,000 years old, the state of preservation is pretty remarkable. But it covered in mud immediately upon sinking. And like a fossil, the situation that allowed for this to happen is very unique. Also, like the fossil record, we know we only get a tiny fraction of a percent of what actually has happened in the record. And despite Flint's claims otherwise, time is definitely a factor on how long something will survive on the ocean floor. I mean, there's places like the Black Sea that have some remarkably well-preserved shipwrecks there, but that's due to the higher salinity and the lack of things eating them, and they still eventually collapse and crumble and fall to crap. And that's not part of the world's oceans anyway, so it doesn't even really count when we're looking at Graham Hancock's lost civilization. The way Flint uses a hole in the record to disprove Hancock reminds me of a creationist asking where the missing link is. Flint is well aware the record is spotty, but he wants to use that lack of something being in it as proof that it doesn't exist. But he's not even thinking his position through, at least not how it relates to Hancock's. Flint has told us why things get preserved, and I've made sure you, the viewer, know the basics of what he said and how the science works. Equilibrium with the environment, covered in mud or silt, encased in barnacles and their mineral-rich secretions, or extreme circumstances like cold or high salinity, are what it takes to preserve a shipwreck. All these conditions rely on stability, the water staying the same temperature, the currents flowing the same, the silt covering the ship consistently. But Hancock's proposed lost civilization was said to have been wiped out by a flood, the oceans of the world causing the destruction on the land. Now, of course, this is contentious. There's a lot of debates about it. The Younger Dryas impact hypothesis and all of that. And there's two very distinct camps fighting about it. And since we have that going on, we can be pretty certain that this debate won't be resolved satisfactorily anytime soon. But what we do know is that the Younger Dryas was a time of extreme climate change in the record. Nobody's going to argue that. And it also changed the sediment layers in the ocean, and it changed the Gulf Stream in the ocean. It changed shit in the ocean a lot. In the following quote from the 2015 paper, The Role of the Gulf Stream in the European Climate, they discuss the changes to the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, a part of the Gulf Stream that is responsible for carrying warm water from the tropics to Europe. Myriad proxies from sediment cores suggest that variations in Gulf Stream transport are coincident with swings in European climate over the past 15,000 years. For example, protactinium-231 and thorium-230 ratios suggest that the rate of the North Atlantic deep water export in the deep branch of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, was reduced during the Younger Dryas cooling, implying an equal reduction in mass flux of the shallow branch of the AMOC. Oxygen isotopes of benthic foraminifera, a type of protozoa, straddling the Gulf Stream on either side of the Florida Straits, are consistent with a smaller temperature contrast across the straits during the Younger Dryas, which is interpreted as a reduced density gradient and a smaller geostrophic Gulf Stream transport. This reduced geostrophic Gulf Stream transport could be associated with a slowdown in either the AMOC or wind-driven components of the Gulf Stream. Nutrient proxies with carbon isotopes and cadmium suggest that during the Younger Dryas, the deep North Atlantic was filled with high nutrient waters, an indicator that this area of the ocean was more sluggishly ventilated and thus the AMOC transport was reduced. Now, there's a lot of words there, and there's a lot to unpack in what the whole Gulf Stream and everything that happened in the Younger Dryas, and that's really outside the scope of this video, but what's important to take note of is that science is very clear that during the time that would have been the destruction of Graham Hancock's lost civilization, the oceans were tumultuous. Things were under a lot of change. So all of the conditions that Flint describes would have potentially been under heavy fire. Things underwater were moving around. The Gulf Stream changed. If it was in cold water, it may well find itself getting hammered with warm water for a minute. If it had been buried with silt, it may find itself uncovered as silt. It was a rough time to be in the seas. And Flint's well aware of this. And if he really thought about this with like an open mind and was trying to have a fair conversation instead of debunk Hancock, he would have known that this was the case and that his point wasn't really going to get very far. But he kind of had blinders on through this whole thing. He kind of had like a little bit of a double standard thing going on and stuff. And my next point will show that to those people. There, some people might argue with me. My final point, you can't really argue with it as far as I'm concerned. It definitely shows pretty clear double standard. Now, Joe does mention the notion of water moving sediment off the wrecks and exposing them to predation again. Pay close attention to how Flint words this.
Now, what about the shifting of sediment at the bottom of the ocean when you're dealing with things like 10, 20,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago?
Yeah, so I was just talking with Jessica Cook Hale out of Bradford about this. And actually, so she's done some studies off the coast of Florida of sort of hurricanes that are coming in today because she's excavating Stone Age shell mounds there. And it turns out, actually, that the hurricanes coming in today really don't disturb them much at all.
He answers a question about the sediment shifting in general with a specific answer that only applies to hurricanes and other surface activities. As I showed in the paper just a second ago, the Gulf Stream changes. This concept is simple. Glaciers melt or other increasing waters flow causes more sediment to end up in the sea. Shifting currents changes the sediment on things that were long covered. This is covered in extreme detail in a couple of papers that I'll link below. Post-glacial flooding of the Bering Land Bridge, dated to 11,000 before present based on new geophysical and sediment records, and rapid oceanic and atmospheric changes during the Younger Dryas cold period. The clearest, easiest quote that I can give you from a legit scientific paper comes from the sedimentary system response to the global sea level in the East China Sea since the last glacial maximum. The abstract says, "The East China Seas, ECS, is one of the world's largest continental shelf seas. Based on the combination of global sea level changes and sequence stratigraphy, we systematically investigated the evolution of sedimentary system in the ECS since the last glacial maximum, LGM. We have defined the transgressive boundary layer and constructed several sedimentary models of the ECS on the sequence stratigraphy and evolution of tidal sand ridges since the LGM, and sediment source to sink during the high sea level. The result shows that the ECS represents a typical case for the large-scale continental shelf response to global sea level change. Three sedimentary system tracts have been formed in the ECS since the LGM. First is a low-stand system tract corresponding to the late of the last glaciation in LGM. The progressive wedge occurred along the Okinawa trough slope and the paleocoastal zone along the continental shelf edge. Second is a transgressive system tract that corresponds to the last deglaciation. A large-scale transgressive boundary layer and tidal sand ridges were formed in this stage. Third is the high-stand system tract corresponding to the high sea level." Notice they say this is a typical case. They have three different types of changes in the way that the sediments laid on the ocean floor right there, on the continental shelf where all the shipwrecks and stuff happen, right? Three different types when the sea level rise, and this is typical. I mean, I could belabor this point for a minute, but I think what's important to point out here is that when Flint spoke about surface level activity like hurricanes, he's not really taking into account the things that Hancock would definitely posit, which would be a flood, which would definitely change the way things are, as science knows. So that was, again, he just kind of dodged the issue there. It seems like a heavy double standard here, or at the very least, like just seriously not thinking things through. Because sediment isn't stable after a flood, neither is temperature. And that's why the oldest boat that we have found is from a bog. It's not from the ocean. Bogs are an environment that stays considerably more stable than the open seas do. The boat is called the Pesce canoe, and it's about 9 or 10,000 years old. Now, when you go back into Roman times and before, there's actually very little in the record, not very much at all in the way of shipwrecks. But we do have some signs of boats being used long before then, even. The Gobaston rock art shows a ship, and it's about 20,000 years old. On the Isle of Wight, a prehistoric boat building site was discovered in 2005. The director of the Maritime Archaeological Trust, Gary Member, had this to say about the site. The site contains a wealth of evidence for technological skills that were not thought to have been developed for a further couple thousand of years, such as advanced woodworking. This site shows the value of marine archaeology for understanding the development of civilization. Now, there's other evidence, too, that people in Southeast Asia, that happened like hundreds of thousands of years ago, and, you know, there's all kinds of little things like that that are, exist all over the world. They think Neanderthals had boats at this point. And you're probably wondering, why would Dan bring up Neanderthals having boats in this video? Well, there's a strong reason. That goes to that second thing I was going to tell you as to, like, the double standards or the blinders, however you want to look at it. We're talking hundreds of thousands of years of people having used boats. They traveled around the globe doing all kinds of stuff, at least tens of thousands of years. Yet we have no boat in the record from the time from 10,000 BC all the way back. We have that canoe as the oldest one. So Flint accepts that the people were using boats 20,000 years ago. I mean, I assume he does. I don't see him in anybody's videos like Stefan Milo's video yelling at him about it. I don't see anything like that. What I do see is him saying that no matter how long something's underwater, it should be okay. So if we're talking hundreds of thousands of years of people using boats, even if they were just, you know, regular old small wooden craft, according to Flint's metrics, we should have tons of them in the water. They should be all over the damn place, on the continental shelves where they look. There should be tons of these ancient ships. We should at least find them. But we don't. That doesn't change Flint's opinion on whether or not they existed. But when we're talking about Hancock's boats, all of a sudden,
I see this as a big, big problem.
Now, and he's not alone here. This debate's being held up as a big win for team science, and it's too bad because a lot of the science was misrepresented to the point that I could be making videos about this for months. Which I won't do that, so that's not a threat, but I will be covering it in a few more videos, and I definitely want to talk at least one about just kind of the overarching strategy, psychological things that come out of this whole mess, because I think that people are missing the boat pretty heavily on that so far. A handful of people see it, but nobody on the YouTube so far. And anyway, I like to tell you guys what I think. So you're going to get that coming down the pipes too. But I also am going to have to, you know, criticize where Hancock went wrong at some point in this thing too, which we'll be doing. But right now, the way that Flint's scientific arguments is being touted is so awesome, I kind of feel like I have to address those first, because a lot of the science there is just 3 million shipwrecks. Come on, man. It's so blatantly, like, so blatantly transparent that it's got all of his buddies going, yeah. But the people on the fence, or the people that were Hancock believers, he ain't really swaying very many. I know that we have some people commenting to the contrary on that, and we'll talk about that in a future video, but whatever. It's very easy to tell when a scientist is not speaking scientifically and is getting kind of emotional. When they're speaking scientifically, you'll hear things like, the data strongly indicates, we're inclined to believe, yada, yada, yada. But when you start hearing them say things like, we know for certain, or we can definitely prove, at that point, you should know that you're not talking to a scientist anymore. You're talking to the person that wears the lab coat, but he's not really wearing the lab coat at that time. Have a good day.
And I'd say we could definitively prove there was no...
You're telling us that archaeology is very keen on new ideas and wants to really explore and investigate the past. Is that right?
That's my perspective, yeah.
That's your perspective. All right. Let's have a look at Clovis first.
Clovis first. Something people skeptical of scientists love to bring up, and something scientists love to play down. Let's go ahead and talk about the implications of this bad boy here. You know what? Right off the bat, I'm going to disagree with Graham. Since everybody's like, oh, you guys are talking now, that means you're never again going to criticize him and you're just going to change and no longer be in the middle and stuff. I'm going to point out where I think Graham went wrong right off the bat, because I haven't been doing that the last few videos for reasons I've already mentioned. One of the places that I think Graham definitely made a misstep is when he was trying to prove that the Clovis first debate was kind of still going now, or had been in very recent times, by citing articles that were like from The Guardian and stuff like that, that weren't really scientific papers.
And so you mentioned this Clovis first hypothesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been decades. You bring up news articles and headlines that say that it's still being debunked. That's not what archaeology is. Our articles ourselves don't say that. Our articles instead present new hypotheses like the Kelp Highway hypothesis, because scholars do not write the headlines for media articles. I cannot help how journalists portray what we do, okay?
So if Graham wants to demonstrate the debate did or didn't end at a certain point, he should be using peer-reviewed published papers, in my opinion. Certainly not just like mainstream journal-y articles, because those could be, you know, written by anyone. And even an unpublished thing written by an archaeologist, I mean, you could have some guy who was 95 years old and still stuck in his ways from the Clovis first days. So, in my opinion, in order to be demonstrably 100%, you should be using peer-reviewed published papers from modern times. Now, for those of you who haven't unsubscribed for me yet, now's the time. And for those of you who unsubscribed for me 2 videos ago, now you're like, oh man, he still does criticize Graham. Oh shit, what did I do wrong? So let's carry on with the rest of the video and discuss Clovis first. The basics of the Clovis first hypothesis goes as follows. 2 great ice sheets, the Laurentide and the Cordilleron, covered the majority of the North American continent for eons. And around 13,000 years ago, they begin to melt, leaving a corridor across an exposed Bering land bridge. Because the sea levels were so much lower, being that all this water was locked up in the ice sheets, there was a fat strip of turf between Asia and America, and this was believed to have been used by the very first inhabitants of the Americas, as there were, and still are, numerous Clovis points for dating around that time period. The belief was the Clovis people were the very first Americans. Clovis points are a unique style of arrow or spear point, and this was used to loosely connect the people across the continent under the umbrella term the Clovis culture. Because the weapon points showed up in the appropriate time to line up with the melting of those ice sheets, this hypothesis looked really good. 2 different lines of evidence seemed to point to the very first human feet touching the Americas around 12 to 13,000 years ago, and this became the orthodox position for decades, at least for 50 years. And this was pretty much fine until French-Canadian archaeologist Jacques Cinq Mars showed up in the late 70s at the Bluefish Caves in the Yukon. And when he excavated the place, he found what he was pretty certain were signs of human butchering on mammoth bones. And the dating on the place was around 24,000 years ago. This basically doubled the age of the peopling of the Americas. And he wasn't shy about it. He had no problem putting this information out into the world. And it was, well, famously or infamously, it was not met with kindness by his colleagues. Science journalist and trained archaeologist Heather Pringle studied under Jacques Cinq Mars, and in an article on the opposition Cinq Mars faced surrounding the Bluefish Caves, she says, "But relatively few of Cinq Mars's peers shared his confidence. And as I began regularly attending archaeological conferences in the years following that trip to the Bluefish Caves, I saw what Cinq Mars was up against. Sitting in halls with Canadian and American researchers, I witnessed what happened when archaeologists presented data that contradicted the Clovis first model. Often a polite bemusement spread through the room, as if the audience was dealing with some crackpot uncle, or the atmosphere grew testy and tense as someone began grilling the presenter. But once or twice, the mask of professional respect slipped completely. I heard laughter and snickering in the room. She was there. She saw firsthand what he faced. And I think it's important to pay attention to what she says here. Because she doesn't say that all the archaeologists on the planet oppose Cinq Mars, but she does say that he faced a hegemony of ideas, basically, that he faced an uphill battle trying to get his ideas out into the public, and that it ended up damaging his career, that it ended up damaging, most likely, his mental health, although she doesn't say that directly. It's pretty obviously implied from the words that are used there. Now, Flint, he's going to downplay this.
That suggests there's an archaeological conspiracy where we're all working together to have one narrative.
No, it suggests that there's a strongly held point of view, there's a paradigm, and that those who go against the paradigm are likely to be attacked, like Tom Dillehay, like Jacques Cinq Mars.
All of them still had successful careers for many decades.
But
Jacques Cinq Mars excavated many other sites.
Right, but
compare that to what Heather Pringle says in her article. It was a brutal experience, something that Cinq Mars once likened to the Spanish Inquisition. At conferences, audiences paid little heed to his presentations, giving short shrift to the evidence. Other researchers listened politely, then questioned his competence. The result was always the same. When Jacques proposed that the Bluefish Caves was 24,000 years old, it was not accepted, said William Josie, director of the natural resources of the Vinutgwitchin First Nations in Old Crow. In his office at the Canadian Museum of History, Cinqmars turned at the wall of closed minds. Funding for his bluefish work grew scarce. His field work eventually sputtered and died. He enjoyed his summers excavating and exploring the Yukon, trying to find exactly areas like the Bluefish Caves, but his, funding and ability to do so just slowly withered over the years. And he's not the only guy that experienced such a thing. The guy that Graham Hancock showed in the debate, Tom Dillehay, he experienced very, very similar things.
A lot of things happened during that span of 20 years before things changed, But can you tell me what your thoughts are in terms of the scientific process? Considering what took place in terms of the dialogue and all the back and forth that happened, is that what you would have expected from the scientific process?
Well, yes and no. I put together an interdisciplinary research team of people, got National Geographic funding and National Science Foundation funding. That went pretty well the way we expected it to. And I found that the scientists were open-minded. This includes archaeologists. We had Australian, Chilean, and Argentinian archaeologists working with us. Cumulatively speaking, those people, besides myself, probably had close to 100 years of experience amongst them. What surprised me on the other side of the coin was the stiff, closed-mindedness of many North American archaeologists. There were some North American archaeologists, particularly those who worked in Latin America, Alan Bryan, Ruth Gruen, a few others, open-minded. Of course, Monteverdi sort of fit the paradigm they were expecting. But I found Europeans much more open-minded. Some of the North American colleagues were very difficult to deal with, and I think at times presenting a very unhealthy atmosphere. Cutting us off before we could present the data at meetings, not talking with us about it, refusing to even look at the data, this sort of thing.
Now here it's pretty clear, he faced a lot of opposition when he went public. But he's also clear it wasn't everyone, it was a very select, specific group of archaeologists that opposed him. Now I know that me and Graham are in contact now, so it's expected that I never disagree with him on anything. But I have to say, I think that Graham misses the significance of this. The distinction between who is involved with the gatekeeping and who isn't is actually very important in my mind. While it's clear that the people who are most directly connected to the Clovis First model, mostly North American archaeologists, were unscientific in their treatment of the site, North American archaeologists who were working in South America were not opposed to the findings out of hand. In fact, as Dillehay puts it,
There were some North American archaeologists, particularly those who worked in Latin America, Alan Bryan, Ruth Gruen, a few others, open-minded. Of course, Monteverdi sort of fit the paradigm they were expecting.
Basically, it's the same old, same old. A few bad apples are ruining it for everyone. Now, Flynn's going to say, oh, it's not really that bad, it doesn't really ruin much. And Graham's going to attribute it to more archaeologists than, in my opinion, should be deemed guilty of this crime, although I can completely understand why, because... Now check it out. He gets a letter, he sees the letter, the SAA letter, for example, to Netflix. It's from the Society of American Archaeology, and it's got effing United States government letterhead, SAA, at 5,000 members strong. It makes it come across that 5,000 people think this should be the thing. And when nobody really speaks up in opposition that has an SAA letterhead themselves, it's pretty easy for him to at least lump those 5,000 into the group that think that he should write off. And so you can't really blame him when he gets a little bit emotional about it, although I will say that that doesn't help a whole lot when you're having the debate, especially the debate on Joe Rogan, because like I mentioned before, Flint could bait that. He could straight up be like, poke the bear, poke the bear. I know you're mad. I know you're mad. I know you're mad. You go into the debate, emotions come out. And I'm like, well, what's the deal, man? I didn't say anything. And the people that weren't aware of all that shit that happened before, they didn't see it happen in the debate. They saw Graham bring it up in the debate. So they can be like, oh, you're the one that's making this a big deal. But it's like, man, anybody who's in the know knows a lot different. So I see where Graham has a problem here. But it is certainly not all archaeologists. It's just a handful. For example, Thomas F. Lynch wrote papers debunking the idea that Ice Age humans existed in South America, and Delahaye wrote papers in response, and this is all back in the 90s about Monte Verde and sites similar to that. I'll link one of the papers below. After that, you can sign into View, and it's free, and it doesn't require anything but a Gmail account, and then others are going to show up next to the articles. You can see all the responses these guys had next to each other, and other scientists weighing in, and it's an old debate, but it's very much worth reading, because we'll see quotes like this from Delahaye. A recent review by Lynch of late Pleistocene sites in South America is impaired by numerous errors and misrepresentations. Now, if you've watched my other videos on the debate, I don't really need to explain this parallel to you. You've already seen it. Flint has kind of consistently misrepresented things and misunderstood where Hancock is coming from. And that puts Graham in a position where he does feel justified in just like railing against archaeology in general. Although, again, I will say that I don't think that that's the answer or a healthy path forward. Although I do get why he feels the way he does. Because let's be clear, when Ancient Apocalypse is review bombed before it's been up for a day, it's clearly an attack on his work and his ability to publicly express that work. This has created quite the Hatfield and the McCoy scenario, although in this case we can safely say archaeologists fired the first shots. Just read Fingerprints of the Gods. It doesn't have the combative tone against archaeologists that Ancient Apocalypse does. But back in the 90s, nobody had called Hancock a racist. Nobody was trying to deplatform him. Nobody had conflated his work with things like,
"They're saying that I embolden extreme voices that misrepresent archaeological knowledge in order to spread false historical narratives that are overtly misogynistic, chauvinistic, racist, and anti-Semitic." I mean, you apply those labels to somebody and you're going to get that person hated.
The point is, I see why Graham thinks the SAA and its 5,000 members are like part of the problem. I've said similar things, even though I was mostly saying it to piss people off, because in reality, I recognize there's a lot of SAA members who really don't have a dog in that fight. Although I will point out that if you're a member of a group that's saying stupid shit like this and you let it run amok, you are letting them sully your group, and then guys like me come along and pick at it. But you know, that's getting off a little bit into the weeds. This whole mess got really bad. It bled into like actually endangering Delahaye's life when you look at the Clovis First thing. I mean, by this whole mess, like, check this out.
And plus, politically, from time to time, there were some difficult moments. At my home institution later on, when I left Chile, a letter was sent to a dean with anonymous signatures of about 24, 25 people saying this guy doesn't even have a PhD, a lie, of course. You should fire him from the university for what he's doing, and so on. And another colleague who sent a letter to the newspaper in Chile, one of the major newspapers, saying that Monte Verde was creation of the CIA to implant me down there. And, you know, that puts you and your family in a dangerous situation in a country like that at that time. So there were several other unpleasant things. So the whole sociology of the non-scientific part of that enterprise was disturbing at times and made me reveal that there's a small, not a majority, but a minority of people who will do anything in their power to defend their paradigm. It was their career, and they had given decades to it. And I can see that from a historical viewpoint now, as the years go by. But on the other hand, I certainly didn't accept it at the time.
I mean, actual fear for him and his family over this debate. Decades before social media even, he was attacked for opposing the Clovis Mafia academically and socially, with the social attacks actually having a good possibility of becoming physical. But history shows us the bad actors are just a few people, a vocal minority, something that those of us who spend some time on social media, we've seen how these guys can paint out a group with just a couple of nutters being the public face of it. But in this case, this is the same kind of hegemony actually existed before Clovis First, and is the same kind of scenario in the Americas, in the debate around the peopling of the Americas. And basically, one guy and his buddy, and then a handful of their cohorts, held the hegemony into place, and kept the peopling of the Americas dating back to about 3,000 years ago, maybe 4,000 years ago if you got crazy, and that was the limit. Ailes Hrdlicka, who totally never got made fun of in school for his last name, was an anthropologist in the first half of the 20th century. And he was firmly of the opinion that the site of Folsom, New Mexico was a hoax, because the evidence said the site was about 10,000 years old, and Hedblicka believed there was no way people were in the Americas that far back in time. And as he was the head of the Smithsonian Institute's Physical Anthropology Division, he was well positioned to block finds from being accepted as legitimate. It took a very long time, but eventually the Folsom site was accepted, and Folsom Man became, for a time, the first human in the Americas. But before that, if you wanted to be an archaeologist in North America, you couldn't posit the peopling of North America before 2000 BC and be successful, or you would run amok of Hedrickla and his friends, and then they would ruin your career. And this is documented well, links below. So this dynamic isn't new, not even in regards to the debate surrounding the peopling of the Americas. And Flint is right when he points out that it's just a few assholes.
Monteverde.
How did you feel when he was describing what was ultimately true, but was being dismissed and he was being shut off and people weren't willing to look at the data? How do you feel as an archaeologist?
Oh, I think that that's complete. I don't mean that what Graham's saying is bullshit. I think it's complete bullshit for any colleagues of mine that try to shoot down actual evidence. That is ridiculous. I'm not trying to say that all of archaeology is like any community of people. There includes some assholes. I have worked with some assholes before.
But these assholes have a lot of power, and this is something Graham recognizes because that power gets used against him all the time. But Flint, he doesn't recognize it because he's one of those assholes. Take the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, or Genung Padang. Now, both have a stark difference in opinion between the people who publish the papers and the quote-unquote mainstream academics. And both have been attacked by the Atlantis Mafia. But unlike the Clovis Mafia, here we have a group of people of different specialties. These aren't all just North American archaeologists railing against the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. And it's not just Indonesian archaeologists attacking the Genung Padang paper published by Dr. Dani Nadewijaja. Jawa, how you pronounce it, sorry. We have the same few people showing up in all the papers against the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and a different group of same people showing up in all the articles talking about the Genung Padang paper. Flint Dibble is one of those names in the case of the Genung Padang paper, and you might see him talking about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis as well. He railed against the Genung Padang paper as though it was somehow his responsibility, his expertise, or even something he was aware about before Ancient Apocalypse aired. To put it bluntly, Flint is one of the figureheads of the Atlantis Mafia, and he will bend over backwards to take down ideas that oppose his beliefs. Despite him saying,
wasn't
well,
one
think
person.
About how many people actually study the Clovis period. That is a tiny period in one area of the world. The majority of archaeologists do not study that. Even Americanist
that's
archaeologists,
completely irrelevant.
Most Americanist
it's
archaeologists
fundamental
study
to the
much
issue
later
of the,
periods.
He himself is not concerned with his expertise or region of study. He's willing to go anywhere Hancock goes in order to prove him wrong. So for all of you who say I never criticize Graham, here's a criticism point blank. He should not have implied that archaeologists in general have created this paradigm that keeps his work from the public sphere. He should have agreed with Flint when Flint says it's just a handful of assholes that do that sort of thing. And then he should have pointed out that Flint is one of the chiefs among those assholes.
You what said you're public enemy number one.
Yes, I am. Clearly, Flint, to you, because you have, and John Hoops, for example, from the University of Kansas. I can play you some stuff from John Hoops, too, if you want.
Roll the clip.
But can we say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization in what they have studied?
In what they have studied, yes, we can say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization.
We heard from Graham Hancock that there is no evidence for his Lost Ice Age civilization.
Atlantis is dead, guys. Atlantis is an idea. It's dead. And Flint Dibble, he might have killed it. What was really strange, though, was that at about an hour and a half through, Graham concedes that none of the archaeology we have at the minute supports the existence of Atlantis.
Well, crap, it seems like there's not even a reason for me to make this video, right? Open and shut case. So why did I even turn on the lights or the camera or the action? All right, so obviously there's something to talk about here, but what is it? Well, let's start by looking at the entire quote instead of just that little piece that Flint showed us.
Yeah, I can go back up there.
We're looking at
Bimini.
Less than 5% of the continental shelves that have been studied at all by archaeology. I'm not surprised that we find hunter-gatherer traces underwater. I'm very glad that we do. I would be very surprised if we didn't. But what I'm saying is that not enough of that 27 million square kilometers has been investigated. Only a tiny fraction has been investigated. And that fraction is not enough to draw the conclusion that we can absolutely say there was no lost civilization. Same goes for the Amazon rainforest. Same goes for the Sahara Desert.
But can we say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization in what they have studied?
In what they have studied, yes, we can say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization.
So here it is quite clear they're talking about the underwater archaeology that's been done, not all the archaeology on the entire planet. Here, listen to the beginning of the clip again.
Yeah, I can go back up there.
We're looking at
Bimini.
Less than 5% of the continental shelves that have been studied at all by archaeology.
Now, Graham does mention the Amazon and the Sahara, so this is still a case of Atlantis of the gaps. But my point here is the quote is being completely misconstrued. He's talking about underwater archaeology only, and they're making it out to be, oh, you know, he said there's no evidence whatsoever of his lost civilization. And Flint kicked that off. Let's be very clear about that. And let's also be clear. If you were to ask Mr. Hancock, hey, Graham, what do you think about the evidence for your lost civilization? What would you provide? He would immediately go to the things that he's mentioned in his books. It's not like I have to speculate very hard here. He would say things like the Piri-Reis map, the Aronius Phineas map, the astronomy that some of these ancient civilizations had that he would say is out of place. Now, you might not agree with those as evidence, but that's what he would call evidence. Myths, legends, gigantic stone edifices that he believes could not be built without some form of higher technology than we attribute to the ancients. For example, even the Great Pyramid falls into this.
Now, the Great Pyramid of Giza is probably the most stunning of all these ancient structures. And the stones are immense, and some of them were cut from a quarry that's hundreds of miles away. How do you think they did that?
Well, some of them, the granite in the Great Pyramid comes from more than 500 miles to the south. If you look at the famous King's Chamber, its walls and its roof are, the ceiling of the King's Chamber are all made with gigantic granite blocks.
Stunning detail.
Stunning detail. Those blocks on the roof of the King's Chamber weigh 70 tons each. Now, Egyptologists will tell you that, oh, they could move heavy blocks because they put them on wet sand and they push them along on wet sand. Well, maybe if you're just at ground level, that will do. But when you're 350 feet above the ground, as you are in the King's Chamber, that won't do at all. I don't know how they did it. All I know is they did it. I don't think anybody knows how they did it, how they lifted those stones, how they brought them up to that level. I think we're looking, again, at a lost technology.
Yes, I just proved to you that Graham Hancock believes the pyramids are products of ancient high technology in order to counter an argument made by an archaeologist. We truly live in bizarro world. One where everyone pretends they don't know what they do in order to feel like they got a win by proxy on Joe Rogan. It's kind of scary, to be honest, because this isn't new. Hancock has always claimed his evidence consists of myth, legend, a few quote-unquote precision things in the record, and the massive stone structures we see around the world. And Flint? Flint is completely aware of this. As a matter of fact, he led with this in the debate as a mutually agreed upon thing between him and Mr. Hancock. Check it out.
Graham is in many ways the first person to admit that the evidence he has is fingerprints. It's kind of what he thinks is this technological transmission to hunter-gatherers, but he does not have any direct dated evidence of this civilization. It's, after all, a lost civilization, right?
So it is a bit underhanded to then hold up a clip of Hancock agreeing with that point, one Dibble highlights that is in fact an agreed-upon point out the gate, and then say, ha-ha, gotcha, especially when he's removed some of the context. And the result of this dishonesty? Well, I showed you a little taste of it at the beginning of this video. There are tons of people that just show up and be like, oh, Hancock said he has no evidence. What are you even talking about? And that's not what he said. But Flint sure made sure that that's how it went out into the world. Flint Dibble then points out we have thousands of underwater hunter-gatherer archaeological sites in the record, and this is true. But he really does ignore a few glaring issues when it comes to what he expects to find. We find stone, and that's basically it, besides a few small exceptions. In archaeogenies, these are known as lithic specimens. They're pieces of stone that have been worked by human hands. From something as intricate and arguably made from high tech as the Schütz disk, to a piece of stone that was knocked off of an arrowhead as it was being made. All of these are known as lithic specimens to archaeologists, and they're considered evidence for human habitation and all that jazz. But what about the evidence for ancient high technology in the record? What would happen if some of that were actually to turn up? Well, a serious problem faced by underwater archaeologists is treasure hunters. Shipwrecks in particular are targeted and looted without being reported all the time, and this has been a problem since before archaeology was even a word. In an essay titled Treasure Hunters Pose Problems for Archaeologists, the following account of a recent organized looting of a shipwreck is given. On October 5, 1804, the frigate La Mercedes came to the end of its journey at the bottom of the sea near Cape of St. Mary at the south of Portugal. A surprise attack by the English wiped out the fleet, which was about to reach its destination. At the time, the two nations were at peace. However, that didn't matter much to the British Royal Navy. The tides and the fish were the silent guardians of the treasure, which remained with the sunken Mercedes for more than two centuries. That is, until its discovery was announced with great fanfare in 2007. Since 1999, electric lights and robotic submarines have been periodically disturbing the peace of the seabed in secret. The company Odyssey Marine Exploration was sweeping the bottom of the sea in search of the wreck, even though this was a potentially delicate archaeological site. It found its target, almost 600,000 silver and gold coins minted in Peru during the time of Charles IV, the King of Spain. The coins were transferred from Gibraltar to Florida, where Odyssey had its headquarters. However, the Spanish government initiated a lawsuit against the company. In 2011, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia, upheld the decision of a Florida judge who ruled in favor of Spain. The coins were returned in 2012 under a legal decision that no longer allowed any type of appeal or reversal. However, investigators still discovered that the company had wrongfully hidden some of the objects recovered from the site in Gibraltar. In the end, the company was forced to return everything and pay a large sum of court costs. So even today, with all the laws protecting underwater archaeological sites from treasure hunters are still a big problem, even in the form of like organized companies going to do it. And we don't know for sure what they hid totally. We just know what we found out that they hid. They may have hid all kinds of cool stuff that we don't know. I've talked about this kind of thing before. Where Are the Missing Artifacts, I believe is the name of the video. There'll be a link down below. The thumbnail looks like that. You know how to find my other videos. I assume if you're watching me, you're astute enough to figure that one out. That's what it looks like if you're interested. But one thing I didn't get into there was if we think of the possibility 10,000 years ago there were people looking for treasure underwater with technology that they recently lost being their primary focus, right? They're looking for old cool tech. It wouldn't be a surprise at all that all we found today was stone, with the occasional piece seeming a bit too well made for the time that it came from, but that's about it. Or consider the possibility of 10,000 years of treasure hunting on the coasts. I mean, people would keep the site secret as long as possible and loot them as much as they could, but the more unique the piece, the more sought after it is, and there's plenty of rich buyers that can change a fisherman's life, and this has been a thing for hundreds of years, if not thousands. Obviously, this is less of an evidence-based argument than it is a logical one, but I personally think it holds up pretty well. I mean, what would you do tomorrow if the end of the world was happening? What would you go loot shit at all? Yeah, I think so, and I don't think you'd be alone. And then 50 years from now, your offspring, what would they be doing? What would they be searching for when they were going around the world trying to survive? I mean, I don't think it's a big stretch to say that these kinds of artifacts would be super-duper hard to find within 100 years, like completely gone from the record. Now, that's not saying that we should never find anything that is anomalous, that we should never find anything like that. It is saying that when these kinds of things turn up, the museum that's willing to put somebody's name on a plaque is firmly in like a thousandth place after eBay, Craigslist, auction houses, black market deals. You get what I'm saying here. There's a lot of shit that's just not going to be in the record. Ironically, antiquity theft and looting is where archaeology began. Collectors wrote books and looked for ways to catalog their collections. And as time went on, this became part of academia, but its origins were in stealing artifacts and selling them to collectors or placing them in Western museums. From the earliest days of Egyptology to the noble savage myth of the 19th century American anthropologists, procuring artifacts from indigenous people has been a central focus of archaeology since its inception. Now, why do I mention this? Well, in that Society for American Archaeology letter, Dibble and others accuse Hancock of spreading white supremacist rhetoric, and their reasoning is Hancock cites sources from the 19th century that are problematic. But modern Egyptologists still cite their early founders, like Flinders Petrie, a eugenicist who was outspoken about the thing. He shows up all the time in the citations of Egyptology. He's straight up racist by modern standards. So the idea that Graham Hancock citing Ignatius Donnelly, who's a guy that was, by today's standards, would certainly be a racist, but back in those days he was an abolitionist and considered a progressive. So the idea that this make Hancock's work somehow part of a tradition of white supremacist rhetoric is laughable when it's coming from an archaeologist. But that's the broad brush approach. You know, I frequently point out that's kind of bullshit, so let's look at Flint himself. Flint is a teacher at Dartmouth. And as you can see in the debate, like many teachers, he likes to use visual aids, real tangible things, to illustrate his point. Dartmouth recently had a problem. In 2023, they had to reevaluate the remains on the campus as they were not in compliance with the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, called NAGPRA for short. I'll let the then-standing president of Dartmouth explain the issue, as he did then to the press. President Philip J. Hanlon, 77, apologized for Dartmouth's wrongful possession of Native American ancestral remains and the resulting trauma to Native American and indigenous members of the Dartmouth community and to the greater Indian country. "I am deeply saddened by what we found on our campus," says President Hanlon. "On behalf of Dartmouth, I sincerely apologize to our entire community. This is an extremely painful discovery, especially for Native Americans and indigenous students and alumni, and for the faculty and staff who believed in good faith that they were not teaching with ancestral remains in their classrooms and labs." Did you catch that last part? Staff teaching in classrooms and labs with ancestral remains of indigenous Americans? Staff like Flint Dibble, who likes to use a lot of hands-on stuff? From his About page, "I'm an innovative teacher who challenges students to think outside of the box and write clear, evidence-based narratives. My goal is to always provide a hands-on experience with the past through primary sources." So there's a very real possibility that at some point Flint was teaching a class with an illegal Native American bone in his hand, immorally obtained and illegal to still be holding. Now, he didn't know that at the time. And maybe it wasn't even him. Maybe it was a colleague of his. But certainly somebody there, the president, said so, right? And here's the issue. This is the kind of thing I would normally never talk about, because this is something they have to clean their own house. This is history correcting itself. We're getting more modern. We're figuring shit out. We fix the sins of our past as best we can. But Flint wants to say, "Oh, look at Graham Hancock's tradition of racism. Look at all these Atlantis hunting people and their tradition of racism because Ignatius Donnelly said some words." So compare the words Ignatius Donnelly said to the still holding bones that you're not supposed to be, quite possibly teaching them in a class when Native Americans might well believe that those bones should not be in a shoebox or in a classroom or a lab. They should be respected and buried in accordance with their religious beliefs. Who is doing the most damage today, right now? It's an absolutely absurd proposition for Flint to come out and say that Graham Hancock's stuff is spreading this kind of crap when he's working at an institution that has to make these kinds of apologies still today. And no matter how Flint wants to spin this, nobody is holding the bones of indigenous people in the name of Graham Hancock. But Flint, he'll just try to diminish all this, and he'll just say,
"Oh, I'm asking you to distance yourself from that,"
But that's not what you're doing, though.
In the debate, he says this, but nowhere else does he ever say this. Just watch how he waffles here. Watch for all the rest of his confidence that he portrayed throughout the debate. He was nervous, but he had some confidence. When Graham hit him with this one and Joe held his feet to it, boy, oh boy, did the flight part of fight or flight kick in, and we just got a bunch of bullshit.
Archaeologist Flint Dibble says Hancock's claims reinforce white supremacist ideas, stripping indigenous people of their rich heritage, and instead giving credit to aliens or white people. Actually, I've never...
Did you really say that?
No, I said that this idea of Atlantis, the way it goes back 200 years, it has been used for those reasons.
So are you saying your quote is incorrect?
I think that it's editing me out of context, Graham. I've never called you a white supremacist or a racist. No. It stripped credit away from local cultures of their heritage.
Right, but he's not doing that.
I never said he did. I said that he's citing these sources.
But this is something that is a very nuanced subject. Mm-hmm. And when you say that it reinforces white supremacy...
Again, I said the sources do.
Reinforce white supremacist ideas, stripping indigenous people of the rich heritage and instead giving credit to aliens or white people. None of those things are true.
I know. Graham doesn't even talk about aliens.
Right. But did you say that?
I said that not in specific relation to Hancock's claims, but in specific relation to this narrative of Atlantis that has gone back hundreds of years.
Here's the Guardian. So they're misquoting you, are they? As Dibble states, such claims reinforce white supremacist ideas. They strip indigenous people of their rich heritage and instead give credit to aliens or white people. Why didn't you get the Guardian to put that right?
Well, I don't.
Did you actually say that, though?
I did not say that Graham reinforces white supremacist ideas. As I've said,
so this quote is not real.
They strip the stories of Atlantis. Yes, right.
So the quote reinforce white supremacist ideas. That's not yours.
No, that's not a quote. It's not in quotation.
Right. It was in the other article. That's what I'm getting.
And again,
they strip indigenous people of their rich heritage and give credit to aliens or white people. Well, in short, the series promotes ideas of race science that are outdated and long debunked. And this is your own,
right? But that's not his quote.
This is your own article, Flint. Here you are. I'm quoting from. That's a quote from your article published in The Conversation.
So this quote is not real.
They strip the stories of Atlantis. Yes, right.
So the quote reinforce white supremacist ideas. That's not yours.
No, that's not a quote. It's not in quotation.
Right. It was in the other article.
He knows he's full of shit. Here's all of his talk of white supremacy in the article he wrote right after the debate. My goal is to share the magnitude and diversity of human achievement. Pseudoarchaeology robs indigenous peoples of their heritage. Hancock's narrative of engineering feats from some lost civilization includes a Sphinx in Africa, pyramids in Mesoamerica, and the enormous terraced monument in Indonesia. Does it include Stonehenge? No. Hancock says ancient British people built that. Hancock and other pseudo-archaeologists center white Europeans as able creators while chalking up the accomplishments of other peoples to outside influencers, the Atlantis civilization, aliens, lizard people, or the lost empire of Tartaria. Real archaeology inoculates people against the online and in-person racists who take Hancock's polished presentation of a mysterious civilization and twist it into overt white supremacy. So where exactly did Flint ask Graham Hancock to distance himself from white supremacy? He didn't, despite claiming so in the Joe Rogan thing and being like, oh yeah, man, that's all I'm out. I'm not calling you racist. I just want you to distance yourself from those guys. In reality, he don't care about that. He never mentions it. I'll link a bunch of the stuff down below where he's cried about this stuff. He never mentions distancing yourself from that. Instead, he conflates all the way to Tartaria, stuff that like a lot of the guys that get a little questionable with it go to. Flint will conflate Hancock with all of it before he gives him any benefit of the doubt at all. It's so intellectually dishonest that, well here we are. You know, normally I accept people thinking differently than each other. You know, what qualifies as evidence for one person just won't for another quite frequently. And in most things, I'm completely tolerant of this. I don't believe in this or that, but I won't call you stupid if you believe in it. But when it comes to character assassination like we see here, I don't find this a legitimate belief held by Flint and friends. I think this is their psychological justification for acting like assholes. Putting things into print that are absolutely abhorrent, and it worked great in the debate because Hancock was upset about it before it even started, and Flint could just be like, hey man, I just want to talk about the evidence. I don't know what your deal is here. But try finding an article that he's written on Hancock that doesn't include these tacit accusations of spreading racist bullshit, and then see if it actually asks him to distance himself from those people. An archaeologist who may well have illegally held Native American bones in his hands while teaching, calling a guy like Hancock a spreader of white supremacist rhetoric, is like a Holocaust camp executioner calling an edgy 4chan poster out for spreading white supremacist rhetoric. As Jesus is quoted with saying, "Remove the log from your own eye before removing the splinter from your brother's eye. That way you can see clearly when you go to take out that sliver." In other words, clean your damn house before you go pointing fingers, Flint. This is why I rail against debunkers who misspeak more than pseudoscientists who I think are completely wrong. Perhaps you have heard of the Milgram experiment? After World War II, wanting to understand how Germany got normal people to commit atrocities against their neighbors, Stanley Milgram conducted an experiment in which scientists in lab coats instructed test subjects to administer electric shocks to other people. The people receiving the shocks were actors, and the point of the experiment was to see how far the test subject would take the experiment before stopping. As many as 65% of the test subjects would administer shocks up to the point that they believed it would be lethal if they were instructed to do so by a scientist. To be honest, this experiment focused on authority in general, but specifically it was scientific authority being represented here. If the impartial person who has more knowledge than I says carry on, I'm going to effing carry on. And that was how the public perceived scientists in 1963. But in recent years, the damage to the reputation of science in general has been troubling to me. Not because I want to dress up in a lab coat and zap people who piss me off. Although, anyway, my issue with these sort of things is that they erode the public's faith in science in a manner that I don't think Flint or many others, even guys like Andrew Rakich from Autenshay Films, who really has a nuanced take film on this debate, he doesn't seem to have noticed this at all. By treating this discussion like a debate instead of
test this hypothesis in a fair way,
he demonstrated a lack of scientificness, I guess you could say. I mean, the impartiality you would expect from a scientist was completely devoid from his arguments. Instead, they were all-encompassing, full of errors that kind of landed on his side of the fence, just happened to at any rate, and basically wouldn't even own the worst shit that he did to Hancock before the debate. It was weaselly. Apparently, he doesn't realize that outside his small community that this does look unscientific as hell. He betrays ego as a motivating factor to any astute observer. Indeed, his entire video covering the aftermath of the debate is dripping with smug comments.
So how did it go is the question I always get. How did it go? Well, let's see. Roll the clip.
But can we say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization in what they have studied?
In what they have studied, yes, we can say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization.
We heard from Graham Hancock that there is no evidence for his Lost Ice Age civilization. This is one of the memes that somebody sent me, and ding, 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 yeah, I feel pretty good. Clearly, I went in as prepared as I could, and there's a whole lot of stuff. I probably only shared 20 to 30% of what I went in with. What I was able to show was, fortunately, just how much evidence we have. We have so much evidence, archaeological evidence, all over the globe. You know, I talked about one of the surveys he did in Egypt in the Sahara. Graham saying, archaeologists have not surveyed the Sahara. Man, plentiful surveys of the Sahara have happened, and plentiful Stone Age artifacts have been found.
Now, he's feeling his oats now, and I understand that, but he's not reaching the people that he wants to reach. Instead, he's preaching to the choir. Do you remember the SAA letter that I mentioned earlier, the one that Hancock mentions in the debate? In it, three reasons are listed for the Society of American Archaeologists requesting the documentary be reclassified as fiction. The first reason listed tells us what the real problem is, why they wrote that letter, why they combat guys like Hancock, and why they frequently get so overzealous that a dumb electrician can highlight the issues in their arguments. The reason is, the host of the series repeatedly and vigorously dismisses archaeologists and the practice of archaeology with aggressive rhetoric, willfully seeking to cause harm to our membership and our profession in the public eye. The second reason highlights the difference between Hancock's theories and the academic consensus. You know, what you would actually expect. Third is the BS cries of racism I mentioned earlier. Their number one reason is personal attacks. You make archaeologists look bad, you make us all look bad, and we're going to come in there, and then Flint came in there, guns a-blazing, in it to win it. But it's all ego-driven, man. Just science, no, fucking nothing to do with science. It's just ego. In my video, Archaeology Needs a Carl Sagan, I point out that the tactics Flint used here is basically wasted efforts. They could be making stories sound more fun and therefore more interesting to the public, but instead they play whack-a-mole with opposing ideas like Atlantis. Now, in my opinion, this is totally a losing proposition for him. And check out that video if you're interested. The link is below. I mention this because Flint is pushing the opposite direction. He didn't just laugh uncomfortably or whatever. he is misrepresenting the science openly in order to try to win this debate. And this is the kind of thing that is just, it is not going to pan out well in the long term. I'm not the only person noticing this. Even Chris Dunn did it at the end of his appearance on Joe Rogan. The entire Atlantis hunting community is looking at Flint's arguments with a fine-tooth comb. And most of us are seeing the same thing. A lot of misrepresentation and a whole lot of ego. And I'm of the opinion that Flint did more harm than good to archaeology and team science here in his performance in the debate. I mean, there's no question shit's more polarized now than when it began, and that's not good for anybody, except people that make content regarding all of this drama.